Greetings to all manifestations of the One Self in all of your permutations and unique self-creations out of all of the infinite potentialities of the infinite consciousness of the Self. You have created unique expressions and manifestations of existence in order for that self to know itself through experiencing the illusion of an other. Each being in the Chidakash, the timeless, absolute present that is a constant background radiation to the phenomenal plane. Each of you has written your biography all long ago, and that biography is being turned into a film that is now being played, and you are playing yourself as a character in this film. But the book that you have written of this film is already completely done. And it's important that you recognize that you're the author of that book, not a victim that the character might believe it is at any given moment in the unfoldment of one chapter or another of the film. And if you get confused between the character and the book and the author, you will not be able to remain liberated from your own text in which you have defined a version of yourself in order to experience the opposite of what you really are, in order to know yourself through that self-contradiction, that ultimate paradox in which the finite and the infinite meet and, like matter and antimatter, annihilate both into the absolute indeterminacy that frees you from the movie and the book and allows a re-dreaming, a rewriting, a reconceptualization, an immaculate conceptualization of who you are and what life is about and what your reality and destiny are becoming. It's very important that you claim the freedom to free yourself from your own text. And every thought you have is that text moving forward in time. And it brings with it all of the presuppositions, all of the implicit beliefs, all of the memories that are held in the subconscious as present fantasies, projections, worries, and catastrophic senses of inadequacy or not being worthy to live or somehow being destined or doomed to unhappiness or failure or whatever are those particular command systems that are put into the subtext of the character, that are placed there deliberately in order to provoke the kind of suffering that will force one to awaken. So the teleological function is at work, but it is at work because you put it there. Each one placed termas in their own life stream to awaken them from their own egoic ignorance. It's not about external sages or lamas or tulkus who come and give you the wisdom of who you are. It emerges at the moment when you have decided it's time to stop pretending that you're the character in the film. So I decided to interrupt your revising of the last retreat tonight for several reasons. One is it's probably the last chance I will have to see Deb and Daniela before you leave. And I wanted to give you both any opportunity to clarify any questions or to be able to say goodbye to the Sangha so that I could hear whatever you would wish to say after this experience of this strange lifestyle that you have dropped into. And also, today is one of those days when the wave of information and energy and tension in the world has taken a leap to a higher notch. Whether you're aware of it or not, you know that the Nord Stream gas pipelines were bombed, sabotaged, no doubt by the U.S., and this has created a point of no return for Europe. You know, Germany always had the option to open the pipelines again and their people would be able to not freeze this winter and have electricity and gas and food and all of that. Nope, gone. The window of opportunity is closed. Not coincidentally, on the same day, the four regions of Ukraine voted to become part of Russia, were accepted, and a very powerful speech by Putin. I don't know if any of you read the transcript, but a declaration, basically, that we were now on a different footing in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, and we can expect a very major escalation of the way things unfold. So as we approach the colder period in Europe, very quickly we're going to see major civil unrest and the consequences of all of this karma hitting the fan and producing effects upon the entire planet that will be that will raise the vibrational frequency of the chaos and the conflict to levels and geographical extents that it has not reached before, and that will accelerate the movement toward that final conflagration. So yogis need to be in that state where we can function to fulfill our mission, as people are going to be falling into despair, terror, anxiety, and literally dying with great hopelessness. And if they can receive through the morphogenetic field a vibrational frequency that gives them access to the liberated level of consciousness that that can help them come out of the matrix and attain that state of peace while still alive, that can bring a soothing of the heart that nothing else will be able to accomplish. Because we are all interconnected, because we're all one self, every yogi who attains liberation from Maya will automatically and spontaneously become a beacon of that divine light that increases the power with which the energy of divine love is disseminated into the planetary noosphere and enables anyone who is praying or meditating to receive some of that energy and be lifted out of despair or whatever negative state they might be in. That's our function. to offer that. But you can't offer that if you are still in some ego state that is suffering yourself. You have an obligation, a duty to free yourself so that God can work through you and you can be free of your own karma and graduate from the wheel of birth and death and complete your service to the world. That will be the only way to make amends for all of the karma of all the past lives. It can only be done now through that total surrender to being an instrument and vehicle of the light and the love. And that non-duality must be the uninterrupted state of consciousness that liberates all from the illusion of suffering. So, this is now for many a race against time. And so it's important to understand the nature of your own resistance to liberation if you haven't broken through it. So I want to talk about the various approaches that have developed in the spiritual game, let's say. All of you know about the module of the 10 yogas. You've had that here. So I'm not going to talk about it in that sense, but I want to talk about the turning of the wheel of Dharma, as the Buddhists refer to it. Because Sat Yoga is the original yoga. It's a return to the original yoga, the Adi Sat Yoga. And that yoga is the source of what became Buddhist yoga, Taoist yoga, the Vedantic yoga. It was the source of all of the yogas, including that of Greek philosophy and the Egyptian spiritual sciences and that of the Judeo-Christian Islamic traditions. All of them were based on that original yoga. That is what we're returning to. But if we understand how the practice and the approach to realization has shifted over time in Kali Yuga, using the Buddhist model as a template, because it's very well articulated. The first turning of the wheel of Dharma by Shakyamuni Buddha was the declaration of the four truths of the Aryas. It's often mistranslated as the four noble truths. It's not the four noble truths, it's the four truths of those who are noble. Okay, I think that's an important distinction. Arya means a being who has become or claimed our true spiritual nobility. It's also important because of the way this concept has been disfigured and corrupted in Kali Yuga to understand that it was not considered a race. There is no Aryan race. But in every race, there are those who are noble and those who are ignoble. At least in Kali Yuga, there are many beings who are not living a spiritually noble life. They're living a more petty life, a more vicious life, a more degraded life, a more addicted and dependent kind of life, not a noble life. Okay? So a yogi is one who has become noble. And so the first teaching, the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma was, if you have forgotten how to be noble, here is how you do it, right? That's what the first wheel was about. And the four truths were truths that were expressed to someone convinced that they were a bodily being in a world. Someone convinced that they really were their ego. They really are the character that they're playing. If you're in that state, then the first turning of the wheel is appropriate for you. But it also ratifies the illusion that you're under. And therefore, at the same time that it produces a gradual exit, it also prevents you from exiting, because the gradual never happens. Tomorrow never comes, right? So the Four Noble Truths are, you're suffering. The reason you're suffering is you have desire, trishna, thirst, right? You want something, and you're not happy. You have dukkha. You're dissatisfied with life, right? You ain't got no satisfaction. Even when you go to Rolling Stone concerts and they don't make you happy. Nothing makes you happy. Okay, how do you deal with that? Well, the way you deal with that in the first turning is you follow the Eightfold Path, right? And so you gradually reform your life. You become more virtuous, more altruistic, more generous. You have the right kind of livelihood in which you're not harming anyone and you're not cheating, lying, killing, doing any of those things. You turn your life into a life that you can be proud of. Right? That's one way to approach nobility. But does that mean that you are going to really eliminate your thirst for liberation and remove that sense that it's not quite right, it's not really satisfactory? No. If you read the lives of the great saints, they were always still beating themselves up for not being saintly enough. You're never perfect, right? Perfectionism will never get you there. And so the first turning of the wheel was a kind of perfectionism. So we're against it, right? But for most people, they prefer that approach because it gives them time to stay in the ego. Because they don't really want to get out of the ego. So they like perfectionism, even when they claim not to, because it allows them to still pretend they're a suffering person and that they can't get out of it. Things are hopeless. They keep falling back and regressing and, right, all of this. And that is creating jouissance. There's an enjoyment of telling the other, I'm not going to be perfect for you, and I'm not going to be happy, and it's going to be your problem as well as mine. Right? And so the ego, because it lives in a state of codependency, enjoys creating problems for the other and projecting that the other is its problem. And if only the other person would change and become noble, I'd be happy. Right? Many egos have that view. You do the Eightfold Path and leave me alone and I'll be fine. Right? I'll be liberated when everybody else is noble. Doesn't work like that. So the first turning was a failure, okay? The Buddhists don't like to talk about it that way, but basically it was a dud. So this became known as the Hinayana, right, path, and then they created the Mahayana. It turned out, this was the Buddhist path. But then, they said, okay, no, this is the path only for a few people who don't get it and they need a kind of perfectionist, gradualist path because they're too embedded in their ego and they don't really want liberation for, a number of eons, a number of kalpas. So let them enjoy, their struggles, their ordeal, okay? And I think, from what I gather of hearing about and meeting and talking to most of the people here, most of you are Hinayana satyogis. Most of you are still in the first noble path, which isn't so noble, and are making liberation an ordeal. You're drawing it out and suffering. Tremendously, even if some days are lighter than others, but every day is kind of a day where you're carrying burdens and you're not quite happy. You're in dukkha, you're not in sukha. You know, you're not in Sukhavati. You're not in the blissful realm in which there's never any suffering. There's always, if only, you know, I could do an ayahuasca ceremony here or there, or I could get drunk once in a while, or smoke a little bit more, or do a little bit of this or that, or if I had a girlfriend, or if, you know, I could, you know, do some tantric practice, or, you know, everybody's got their own little shtick, if only, you know, or maybe if I only some cookies even, or if I could watch some porn on the internet, or if I could, you know, you're probably doing all these things, but in any case, you want more of it, or you want something different, or a different flavor, or whatever. But you're always unhappy, no matter what it is. Okay, so how many of you are Hinayana yogis? Anyone willing to put your hand up? Okay, well, anyway, I'm glad there aren't any. I'll take your word for it. But the first turning of the wheel didn't work. So they came up with a second idea. And the second turning was this. They said, look, this character that you're playing that is hopeless, you know, and that wants to pretend to be good, but at the same time to not really be good, that's very happy being hypocritical and, you know, wanting to continue its projections and judgments on others and superiority complexes and all of that, plus your inferiority, and you want to have the experience of this self-torment, because it will make you an artist or something. You know, most people, you know, they have to have torment to feel they're really alive, you know? And the more tormented you feel, the more valuable your life is, you know? You're really struggling. You're there at the core of reality, you know? Because you're making yourself miserable. Those people who are happy, they're missing out, you know, on the value of life, which is suffering. You know, look at Van Gogh, you know, look at all of these suffering artists. They produce the greatness in the world. Happy people don't produce anything. They're white bread. They're bland. They're nothing. You know, who wants happiness, right? Okay, that character is fictional. That's the second turning of the wheel. The character that you're playing lacks self-nature. This is the teaching of emptiness of self nature. It is not yourself. It is an algorithm. It's a robotic program that was installed in you by other people, namely your parents, in early childhood. Your ego isn't yours even. You are an extension of their fantasy of who they wanted you to be. All right? You're so proud of your originality, but all you are is an expression of the amalgam of their psychoses, which doesn't amount to very much, all right? So, if you can recognize that this perverted character you're playing is not you, you will be free of most of the burden of your life. It is not you. It is empty of any reality. Therefore, there's no point in following the Eightfold Path or, you know, worrying about the yamas and niyamas or following the Ten Commandments or, you know, praying on Yom Kippur to be forgiven and freed from all of your dirty activities of the year and, you know, all of the things, the Ramadan fasting, whatever it is. That's a fictional character who's trying to improve itself through trying to make good to God. But that God is yourself. You know, you're making a, not only do you not exist, but the God you believe in doesn't really exist. Sorry, that's not nihilism. It's Buddhism, but it's not nihilism. But what it means is that that God is only your real self that you still are not claiming because you're identified with this fictional character who thinks that if I just do these things and I'm a good boy or a good girl, that then I'll get some, you know, praise and I'll be okay and God will treat me better and life will get better, right? All of those things are fictional. They're superstitions. it's okay if you're a child and you want to believe in Santa Claus and, you know, you be a good person and all of that, and you'll get nice toys on whatever day that he's supposed to come and bring them. Maybe you'll get nice toys, and maybe there'll be a disappointment. But the point is that the character is fictional. It will never be happy, but the good news is it's not you. So that was the second turning of the wheel. If you could just get that, that not only is the character not you, the whole world is just a construct of the mind of that character. Everything you think you're experiencing and being a victim of, because all of the other people are nasty to you, or, you know, they don't recognize your greatness or whatever, all of that is your own projection. It's your dream. It's a creation of your own sanskaras. Your own subconscious self-hatred comes out in the relationships and in your own dependency on being okay to the other. Getting approval, validation, affirmation, etc. And you don't recognize that you are creating your own world, including the hell realms that are produced in your body by symptoms of physical illness and by mental illness and by karmic catastrophes, etc. All of that, if you recognize, comes from your own mind, not from outside, you can detach from it and extinguish those tendencies and then change your life. It will change magically, spontaneously, when you know it's not your life, it's a program you breathe life into, and you can take the breath out of it and it deflates and disappears, and then the real can emerge, all right? So that's the second turning of the wheel, which is that everything is false, empty of reality, and worthless, and don't buy into it, okay? The problem with that second turning was it was misinterpreted as a kind of nihilism, right? Well, if nothing is real, then what's the point, you know? And why don't I just act out and do everything that I was going to do as this character? Because nothing is real anyway. And so the second turning of the wheel turned into a kind of a dud. And what happened was it created a lot of pundits. It created a lot of people who became almost violent proselytizers of the way. You have to believe there's no self, right? The Buddhists believe there's no self. The Hindus believe there's a self. They're wrong. We're right, right? So it creates a conflict, and we're better than you in the same way that, you know, Christians, Jews, and Muslims all think they have the right God, and everyone thinks their path is right. So the second turning, unfortunately, because it didn't create a universal sense of what is real, but only that it's all unreal, it produced a need to feel real by thinking, okay, I know the truth. That's all that's left, is the truth that there's no truth. But I'll fight for that truth, and I'll demand that everybody recognize that that's the truth. But that truth is only a truth within the construct of the matrix of illusion. It's not really a truth. It's only a truth that is conceptualized by a fictional character. So the second turning of the wheel cannot be true either, because a fictional character cannot know the real. So they had to move to a third turning of the wheel. The third turning of the wheel was what is often referred to as other emptiness, which means, yes, the world is empty of reality, but there is a real self that is empty of the ego and empty of the world and empty of all constructs. But it's real. That's the fullness, right? If you can get into the understanding that though everything your mind thinks is unreal, the mind's nature itself is real. But the mind's nature is just luminous presence without an ego, without an intention, without a body, just pure light, infinite, boundless light. If you can get that, then you've got something to hold on to that is real, that is so powerful that you can then overcome the need to be somebody. Because what is real is not anybody, not anything, not anyone, but there is no longer any dissatisfaction in that state. Now, you'd think that, okay, third turning of the wheel, that's it, we can stop there. The problem is that the one who gains that sense of fullness still tends to believe that they exist as beings who have realized the fullness. But there is no one who can realize that fullness. Only the fullness itself. And the third turning of the wheel tended to say that fullness is obscured by an ego and you have to do something to remove the obscurations, right? You have to cleanse the mind of all of those thoughts and beliefs and concepts that are blocking that fullness from being realized. But that's not true, because it's only a fictional creature who is creating the obscurations. And as soon as you believe that you are a fictional creature, you have lost the fullness. So in a practical way, the teachings still sabotage themselves at that level, because they are delivered as a conceptual understanding. And the conceptual understanding, because the ego is codependent on its own mind and believes its own thoughts, brings it into a state in which it thinks, I have got it, I have grasped it, I grok the real. And that thinking that there is an I that gets it causes you to lose it. So, because the third turning of the wheel didn't work, and because in general it was presented by the Tibetan Buddhists in particular as a gradual process of removing obscurations, it became considered. They developed a doctrine called the Tathagata Garbha doctrine, which means that everyone has the seed of a Buddha within them. And all you have to do is grow the seed and you become a Buddha. The problem is the seed never grows. And you remain there with a seed of Buddha, but how does it sprout? How do you get it to sprout? The problem is you can't get it to do anything because you're not real. And so there was still a duality within the third turning. So this is why the fourth turning had to happen, which is the Zen movement, or let's actually say Chan, because it's the early Chan Buddhists in China who let go of all the scriptures, all the beliefs of Buddhism. They said, burn the Buddha. If you see a Buddha on the road, kill him, right? All of that. And they no longer used concepts. The early Chan Buddhists would just shout at each other or slap each other or, you know, at most give some nonsensical answer to a question or a riddle or something like that, but or just walk away or laugh hysterically or whatever. But there was no attempt to conceptualize it. And this actually worked for a while, okay? Eventually it stopped working because, you know, the Zen thing is we don't believe in scriptures. We don't read that stuff anymore. We just, you know, scream and shout and live in immediacy. But we don't actually create a system. We don't have a literature. But eventually they began to systematize all of these riddles. They made collections of Zen koans. They made rituals and processes. And even when they recognized that you should just sit, they wrote books about how to just sit, you know? And so they turned their freedom into a system. And once you have a system, you have a symptom. Because now you're a Zen Buddhist and you have an identity, and you're not just an immediacy of presence any longer. And again, you're in the same spot. And so the Zen tradition began to decline until it really is not in existence any longer, except in books or maybe an occasional Zen master. But as far as I know, the last one died in France some years ago. Maybe there was one in the U.S. also who was, lost in a scandal. Leonard Cohen's Roshi, for example. Sasaki Roshi, right? But there are very few. And the Zen school is pretty much dead. So that was that one. That was the fifth, right? That was actually the fourth is the Tantra. I don't know. Maybe I didn't go into the Tantra enough. The Tantric Buddhism before the Zen. The Zen is the fifth. I skipped the Tantra. The Tantric Buddhism is the Buddhism not of Tathagata Garbha, but Sugata Garbha, which is different. In other words, it's not that you have a seed of Buddha within you. But the whole Buddha, who is already complete, is sitting in your heart. All you've got to do is enter your heart and realize you are the Buddha. All right. So that was the fourth turning. That no need to eliminate obscurations. The obscurations can remain, but you be in your heart and in your Buddha nature. And even if you still have a horrible ego, it doesn't matter, because your energy of your Buddha nature will gradually wash it out. But don't worry about it. It's not real, right? So that moving the attention away from the ego, or away even from the soul, trying to love God enough to attract the grace or the immunity from buying into the seductions of the ego. All of that could be sidestepped by realizing you are the Buddha already, or the goddess, or the Dakini, or just the luminous clarity, but you—that's what you are. Thou art that. It's a return to the same as the Advaita, but it's put into this mode of recognizing that whatever state you're in is irrelevant. The problem is it didn't matter because the attention kept going back to the gross mode, the more dense materialized consciousness, and wouldn't stay in the heart. Because the ego, as it devolves, creates thicker and thicker defenses against the heart becoming vulnerable. And so the process theoretically should work, but practically it stopped working because the nature of the ego devolved to become more paranoid and more cynical and more hopeless and more disbelieving of the possibility that, come on, am I really Buddha in my heart? Give me a break. I can't believe that. Are these people all Buddhas who treat me so badly? Impossible, you know? So it's that kind of cynical ego that wouldn't allow the fourth turning to be successful. The logic of it works, but the practical capacity to carry through the leaving behind of the ego's nonsense and its critical cynicism would not allow it to be in a state of vulnerability and emptiness and purity and innocence because of fear that it would be taken advantage of, exploited, and somehow caused to suffer more. Because it decided in childhood, never again will I trust anyone, certainly not even myself. So anyway, that's why they had to go to the fifth turning and get rid of concepts, but that didn't work either. So then what I consider to be the sixth turning of the wheel, not everyone considers this, but I think it is the Chöd movement. With Matchik Labdron, remember we've studied her teachings. And those teachings began with the understanding that the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma, but all the Dharmas of all the egos in the world had become corrupted and degraded and was getting worse and worse every day because we were heading toward doomsday. We're heading toward the time when the demonic forces will be hegemonically in control of the world. This is part of Buddhist understanding from the beginning. But what they recognize is we're now in the latter days. And so our ability to be Buddhas now, it's gone. We can't do it anymore. We're too weak and we're too embedded in our ego. And we've got too much karmic baggage to get out of it. And so the Chöd approach was, the only thing we can do is to face our fear and maximize our confrontation with our own fear. And at that point of maximal facing of the fear, recognizing that those fears are created by our own mind, to sever. The whole idea of Chöd is sever, cut completely your identification with that fearful ego complex. But let the demons eat your ego. Let him have it. Let him even eat your body. Be fearless, but offer yourself instead of trying to protect yourself, because the ego wants to protect itself and survive. And so the Chöd idea was to counteract the evil, which the ego, which is evil, which is defending itself against the demons, and by doing that becoming a demon, and you know, you are what you are afraid of and what you project, to let the demons kill and eat and devour the ego and all of that which it identifies with. And as that is happening, to cut your connection to that and realize you're free now. Let the demons have what they want. Let Caesar have what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's, right? Same thing as Jesus was saying. So the Chöd idea was just cut it in the midst of the most terrifying situation you can imagine. So the world is now bringing us to a Chöd moment, when everyone is going to have to face that. You don't have to sit in cemeteries and hope evil spirits will attack you anymore. You'll find them on Main Street. You'll find them, you know, everywhere you go. You won't be able to avoid them. So we're in that moment where unless you cut your identity, you're going to be sucked into that demonic terror. And then the only way out of terror is to identify as a demon, to become terrifying instead of terrified. And that's what demons do. And they become accomplices in order to avoid being afraid of their own minds externalized as the other. So, Chöd didn't work though. And Matchik knew it wouldn't work, but she said, you know, at the end, we will all be released because Mara itself, the grand demon of all demons, will turn into God by severing us from the illusion and returning us to the singularity of our Buddha nature. And so we'll be freed anyway, so don't worry about it, right? because it's all fictional anyway. This is just a movie. But for most people, that's not of much practical use. So now we're at the point where we realize that nothing works. No technique can get you there, no concept, no map, no insight, no prayer, no bhakti, no drugs, and nothing is going to get you there because there is no you there to get anywhere. So the seventh turning of the wheel, which I propose that Sat Yoga is the recognition simply that your not getting it is the way you get it. Okay? There is no wheel to turn because there is no real being to turn it. All of it is fictional. All of it is perfect. Not perfectionist, but it's perfect. And all of it has to unfold the way it unfolds. But the trick is to realize one thing. And this goes back to the understanding of the avastas that the early yogas were focusing on, Jagrat, Swapna, Sushupti, and Turiya, right? So, if you could recognize that right now, at this very moment, you might think you are awake, but even if you are awake, in the sense that you think you are awake, you are also dreaming. Everyone is dreaming now. At the same time that you're in a waking state, you're in a dream state. And it's very easy to recognize that. If you just tune out what I'm saying for a moment, you'll see dreams are going on, daydreams, fantasies, memories, things you wish you were doing instead of listening to me talk right now. You know, all kinds of fantasies will be going on in your mind. You know, like, why can't I get out of this ashram and, you know, and get a drink somewhere? You know, whatever. You're going to be having all kinds of thoughts that have nothing to do with what seems to be reality to the waking state. That dreaming is going on all the time. It never stops. Okay? Even when you're dead, the dreaming doesn't stop. That's what the bardo state is. You won't stop dreaming. You think death will end your nightmares? Uh-uh, won't do it. Okay, you're awake and you're dreaming, but you are also in deep sleep right now. You are all in deep sleep. Okay? Now, if you can get the fact that you are in deep sleep while you think you are awake, you will realize that it's in deep sleep that you reach the state of realization that you're not a body. In deep sleep, you have no body. And no matter how much pain your body is in, no matter how many symptoms your body has, if you're in deep sleep, none of that is real. When you're in deep sleep, you are liberated. But the problem is, because you're not connected to the fact that you're also awake in deep sleep, it doesn't last. And the alarm clock wakes you up and you say, damn, I got to go and meditate again, and I, you know, all of this. And, you know, the grind begins again. And then you're dreaming of, well, maybe I should move to Ibiza, you know, and change my life altogether. What am I doing here? You know, all of those things will happen. But if you could remain in the state of deep sleep while the body is going through those other avastas, you would remain in that luminous clarity and peace and silence and liberation. Because that's all nirvana is deep sleep that you recognize awake. That's all. There's no mystery to any of this. And that's all the Turiya state is. When you realize that there is a background presence that doesn't change, whether you're in deep sleep, dream, or waking. and that these states do not occur successively, linearly in time. It's just that one becomes dominant and the others become recessive. You focus on different ones. But even in the middle of being awake, you'll suddenly, by 11 a.m., get tired and start going like this, you know, and needing a cup of coffee or something to wake up again. The sleep state will want to intervene in the middle of when you're awake and is, where am I? Those things will happen. Or suddenly you'll realize, wow, for the last 10 minutes I've been dreaming. I didn't hear a thing Shunya said. What was he talking about? You know, right? You can't keep your attention in the waking state. It's too boring, you know. So you're in all of these states simultaneously. If you would recognize that you're also in the state that's aware that you are simultaneously in all the other states, then that state would remain dominant. And then you would be in Turiyatita, and none of the other states would be real to you anymore. That's liberation. And because that is already the case, all of those states are all present now, and you are in all of them, regardless of the state that you think you're in all of them. There is no one to do anything, because all these states are is nirvana, the intermediate state between lives, and the state in which you believe you're alive as a person in a world. But they're all present. And the only time when they aren't all present is that time of the singularity, when the God consciousness wakes up so totally that the world disappears completely. But that is the Turiyatita state. It's not a state that has to happen at the end of time in a linear sense. It's simply the end of the timeline of your soul, because your soul has entered Turiyatita. And then the ego is washed out, and all that remains is that luminous, blissful clarity, regardless of anything that seems to be happening to beings who are still dreaming, because you're not in that dream anymore, and you're not creating concepts of duality. There's no ego, no subject-object separation. And that liberation is your real state right now. So it's only through that realization that there is no one to do anything. It's hopeless to try to do anything. And yet at the same time, there's nothing that needs to be done because you're already in nirvana. And everything is absolutely perfect as it is. And the moment that is fully accepted, all of the suffering, all of the desire, all of the fear, everything falls away. And the bliss of that ultimate nature, because it is more coherent than any of the other partial states that alternate in time, because it's the state that is prior to time, that state becomes the default position, the position of consciousness that, because it's changeless, becomes the one that is chosen. That's grace, but it happens by itself. So we're in that moment when everyone's biography has written that this will be realized. It is written. And once the moving hand has written it, it's done. Destiny is complete. And because it has been written for everyone that this will occur at this point in the cycle of time, there's nothing to do but attend to the truth of what you are. Has this been helpful to anyone here? No? Okay. That's all I have to say. And we got 10 minutes if anyone has any questions or comments. Okay, you got one.
Thank you, Shunya, for the teaching tonight and for elaborating on all of these different turnings. Mm. I've had this question for a while, so I'm glad you brought this up again. If all of these are turnings of the Wheel of Dharma, what is the Wheel of Dharma before it turns?
Well, it's simply the birth and death. It's simply one day after another, and it's simply a feeling of cluelessness and of wanting to figure it all out. So the first turning of the wheel is when the light goes on and said, ah, I get it. This is my problem. This is what I have to do. So that's usually the first the time that one becomes conscious of themselves in their ego life. You realize, oh, wait, I'm my own person. I'm not what the family system says I am. But who am I? I don't know. Who do I want to be? What do I want to do, right? And how do I get out of this suffering? So it's that moment of consciousness in which you realize that you have the power to make things different from what they were. And there's an awakening. Before that, you're not awakened. The mind is just in its ego and assuming that's all life is. And most people are identified with what their parents have told them they should be and do. So they're going through life, going to law school or medical school or becoming accountants or, you know, getting MBAs, whatever. They're doing this, you know, and marrying people their parents would want them to marry, you know, and having children because they're supposed to, and getting mortgages because you're supposed to. You know, they're doing all of those things, but only because those are the rules. There's no actual consciousness of one's freedom and one's power to create one's own life. That's when that happens, that's when the Dharma wheels turn.
So it's avidya.
What's
avidya.
That?
Ignorance.
Yeah, that's right.
It's
even ignorance of the fact that you're ignorant.
Is it the Dharma that Buddha had to face?
Yes. When he was a prince, before he was a Buddha, everything was perfect, right? But he began to question. Well, wait a minute. Why am I a prince, and why is this like this? And then he saw that it wasn't the way he was told it was, right? He saw the sick guy and the old guy and the dead guy, and then he said, "Wait a minute, that's going to happen to me? I'm out of here." So yeah, that was his awakening. But it took him a long time between that moment of awakening to, this is not what I thought it was, to getting it, getting those truths and changing his life. And he had to play the game of following what he thought were the rules of getting to liberation. And then he realized, no, that didn't actually work. But then he just ended up creating another set of rules. It didn't really help anyone. So again, it was a repetition of the same problem. Why did Buddhism have to form? Because the Vedantic establishment of Brahmins had fallen. They were just egos parroting the Vedas and the Upanishads, but they were no longer liberated rishis. They were just telling people, you know, what to do, and nobody wanted to hear that. So different establishments grew up of other people telling them what to do, you know, because everybody wants to be the one who tells you what to do, not the one who is told what to do. So more and more religions formed and more popes, you know. You know what, Robert Anton Wilson would make everybody a Discordian pope, right? You write for it and he'll send you a card, you know. So everybody wants to be the pope, you know, but the problem is nobody's going to have followers because everybody else is going to disagree with you. So, you know, the idea it can't be to be somebody and to know anything. That has to be given up. So that's really what knowledge is giving up the idea of wanting to know anything. Okay? That's jnana. And the yogi who is awake is the one who refuses to come out of deep sleep. That's all awakening is the refusal to stop sleeping.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Also a very joyful night. I had a question. This teaching of the four states, I've never really understood it, obviously. But when you were talking tonight, I thought about the soy burger module, and I had a question. Could we think of the wakeful state as the conscious mind, and then all of the structuring energies or levels of the subconscious as dreaming, and then the Atman as deep sleep? Would that be another way to kind of understand all of these states happening at once and different ones emerging?
The soul is deep sleep, not the Atman.
Okay.
The soul. The Atman is the Turiyatita state.
Okay.
Right? So what you have to get is that the Gestalt therapists were right. You cannot have a foreground without having a background. Okay? The foreground only appears to the background, and every picture has to have both. But not only do you have to have a background, there has to be a ground of the background, right? So when there's a subject and an object, you have the object is the foreground and the subject is, in a way, the background, right? But the subject who thinks about the object is creating mental objects that are now in its foreground. Mm. So there's always a deeper background than the subject. So whoever you think you are, there's an awareness of the fact that you're thinking that. And that awareness is what you are. That awareness never shows up in thought. And that's why you have to give up thinking in order to know who you are. Because you are that deep background that is projecting all of it. And when you're in the deep background, you stop projecting, and then everything is just light and liberation.
Is that deep background the soul, or is that a...
No, that's the Atman, the deep background.
Okay.
But the soul is the deep sleep in which there is a momentary stoppage of the thought. It's like a samadhi state, right? Mm-hmm. It's a negation of the ego. But that negation is still not complete. There has to be a negation of the negation, right? The ultimate realization that there was nothing to negate because there was nothing real. Only the deep background is real.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Danielle.
Thank you, Shunya. Speaking of background, and this might tend a little technical, but when one is in silence, Paramahansa Yogananda used to say, focus on the spine, that's where electricity flows through. And today for me, it has become quite of a calling to kind of bring my awareness and my attention to this kind of behind. I know there's the term container too. What is that behind? Is it the observer, the behind? And then ultimately, once there is an utter claiming that goes both ways, Brahman and Kundalini rising, then it permeates, but first it's behind? Does that make sense?
No, it's only behind thought, okay? So, you see, this technique is the same as a mantra or anything else. You don't have to focus on your spine. You can focus on anything. But the question is, who's doing the focusing? That's the deep background that's behind. Who am I who is focusing? And that I turns out not to be in your body at all. It's not a bodily being. It's a concept. It's a thought. But where is a thought? It doesn't exist in space. It has no spine. It has no form whatsoever. It's non-existent. It was never created. So, and that thought of who am I or I am or whatever, that's just a mental creation. It's an object. Who is it who is aware of the fact that someone is thinking this? That someone is a fiction. There is no one. There is only the pure awareness. That's all that is. That awareness, once there's an I thought within it, it grows a whole story, a narrative of a life, and other people, and attachments, and loves, and hatreds, and melodramas, and all of that. All of that is fictional. what is behind it all is just the real luminous presence of consciousness that never changes. Once you're in that state, you don't want the melodramas anymore.
Right, and there are moments of realization, one could say, right? And then we get kind of pulled back into the melodrama.
You don't get pulled back. You choose to go
you
back.
Choose.
You need to take responsibility for it. It's like Cypher in The Matrix. I'm going back. I like the taste of steak. Sorry, guys. You know, hey, you can have your Zion. I'm staying in The Matrix because I enjoy the intensity of experience that it gives me. Even if I'm suffering, I prefer that to nirvana. It's a choice. When you have said to yourself and really chosen, no, it's time for nirvana, I'm done, it will happen without any resistance.
Okay. Quick second or third question here. As one is going through the, let's call it purification process, even if it's Anamaya Kosha or whichever body or all the bodies, personally, I've been going through meditation where I get pulled like a really jerk to the right. It feels like a chiropractic adjustment, and I was hoping you could speak to what that is, where that's coming from. Is it just a blockage that it's been going for a while?
There's a thought that underlies it that goes back to a childhood trauma, and there's something you didn't want to see that causes you to turn away from something. It's not what you're turning toward, it's what you're turning away from. And if you meditate upon that and say, what is it that would be too unbearable to witness that I have to turn away from and not see? There was something that happened in childhood. And I don't want to say what it is right now, but there's an image that you could get, I think, very easily, if you're willing to see it. And it will create sadness and tears and all kinds of things once you see it. But when you do let go of it, you will find that a lot of desires and intentions that have formed as a reaction formation to not seeing that will change your life in many ways that were not considered to be part of this one little action, but that actually have huge generalized ramifications.
Okay, thank you. I'll talk to Radhama tomorrow.
Okay, good. Do you want to say anything to the Sangha about your journey here?
Oh, well, it's been absolutely transformational. And you said something in the beginning that said that this experience might be something like weird or something, but it's just terribly familiar. Everybody here feels like the soul tribe, so I'm going to miss everybody and hope to be in touch.
Okay, wonderful.
Mutually.
Blessings to you on your journey.
Much love.
Deb, do you want to say anything?
It's been amazing for me to be here. As I said to Purusha in my sort of follow-up conversation with him, the Sangha presents itself well online. I had a pretty good sense of you online, but there's still nothing like being here with you in person. And just feeling the love and the sincere intention in everyone, that's what strikes me the most, is just the sincere intention of really walking the talk and doing the deep inner work. You're all really role models for me. I feel like a rank beginner at that. And so it's been very inspiring for me to be here. And the love in this community is palpable. As soon as you come into the ashram, I haven't encountered anything like that anywhere else in my life. It's been a memorable experience, and I feel as though I've been pampered at every level. Amrita and Swati have taken such good care of us when we were in the cocooning phase, and then coming out into the community. I mean, the meals have been incredible, the conversations have been wonderful, the teachings unbelievable, and everything is so, the whole curriculum is so beautifully integrated, and all the pieces reflect on each other. They're all different facets of the same teaching. And it's just been amazing for me to be here. So I feel such deep humility and gratitude. So thank you.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you. It's been a joy to have you here, and blessings on your journey, and we hope to see you again. Okay. Is there anyone else who wants to add anything, subtract anything, multiply, divide, whatever you'd like to do before we adjourn?